Welcome to The Compound and Friends. All opinions expressed by Josh Brown, Michael Batnick, and their castmates are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, hello. Good evening, everybody. It is 5 o'clock on the East Coast, so you know what time it is. What are your thoughts? My name is Michael Batnick, and I will be hosting today. Downtown Josh Brown is down in Miami with Sprinkles. They're taking TJ to the University of Miami, which makes me feel very old. When I started with Josh, I think she was, six? She's younger than Kobe, so this is weird. Time flies. Sitting in my seat tonight is the amazing Callie Cox. For those of you who don't know who Callie is, she is the chief market strategist at Ritholtz Wealth Management. Callie, welcome to the show.
Mike, what is up? I'm so excited to be here, and I feel like I have really big shoes to fill.
You're filling my shoes.
I kind of do, yeah.
So last week was a quiet week on Wall Street. The S&P closed flat. No big deal?
Nah. I mean, nothing happened, right? Boring week.
Nothing happened. No. Somebody emailed me, actually. A friend of mine said, I went on vacation last week, was without a phone, came back. Nothing happened. There's a market lesson in there.
Yeah, there you go.
Callie, we have a sponsor for today's show. It's Rocket Money, which is a personal finance app. I use it all the time. I like when I get refund detected, large transaction. Did you do that? Hey, what is this? Oh, yeah, I reckon that's mine. That's mine. So every week I see how much money I spend compared to the average. It lets you cancel unwanted subscriptions. So, for example, I found that I was subscribed to things more than once. I shit you not. So Rocket Money has over 5 million users. They've saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money and time on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/compound. That's rocketmoney.com/compound. All right, let's get into it. Last week, there was a narrative shift. It actually started 2 weeks ago. A big narrative shift. The SOM rule was triggered, which says, you probably know better than I do. The 3-month moving average of the unemployment or the unemployment, something like that, whatever.
You got it, Mike.
Triggered. Oh my, it triggered.
It happened.
So there was a hardcore narrative shift of soft landing to why didn't the Fed cut? To, oh shit, the data is really slowing. And I think at the epicenter of the narrative shift was or is the jobs market. Chart on, please, John. So we have initial jobless claims trending up and to the right. And luckily, we got a surprise reprieve last week. But the unemployment rate has kept climbing or keeps climbing. And these sort of things, the unemployment rate, once it gets going, it tends to not slow down. What are your thoughts on the overall labor market and where the economy is today?
Well, Mike, I think you set that up really well. And I think the reason why people are worried is we see this data breaking down. The job market has been slowing for, over a year now. But we're at the point where it feels really uncomfortable in real life. I mean, I don't know about you, but I walk around Charlotte and I see a lot more we're closed signs than find, than like we're hiring or find help. Guys, it's 5 p.m. My brain is scrambled.
You've got a lot of TV in the last 2 weeks.
Still getting used to this hour. But anyway, I feel like we experience in our life experience, you know, we feel that the job market is slowing down and, you know, I'm feeling that too, but, and now the data is confirming it. So everybody's like, all right, well, here we go. This is the big one. And if you're worried about the job market, you're actually worried about the right thing in the economy. Consumer spending is 70% of the US economy. And it's as simple as if you're making money, you're probably spending money. And that's consumer spending right there. So Mike, I think people are freaked out by the unemployment rate. I think they're a little rattled by what we saw in the SOM rule. And the SOM rule was triggered. It was, I think it's the 3-month average of the unemployment rate over like the 12-month average maybe. But
well, let me give you a counterpoint. We have a counterpoint.
All right.
Chart on, please, John. So this is from Torsten Slok looking at the SOM rule itself. And he says, actually, the SOM rule doesn't work because it was designed for a decline in labor demand, not a rise in immigration, which is where a lot of the shenanigans are coming from in the data. But if he looks at the job cuts, and this paints a much different picture. So yes, unemployment is climbing, but job cuts, there's not a lot here to be worried about within this particular data series. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Claudia Sahm, she's the economist who created the Sahm rule. She would say the exact same thing. In fact, I'm pretty sure she talked to Josh last week and said exactly that. But that's right. I mean, something that I think throws people off is that there can be good unemployment and bad unemployment. Bad unemployment is what we think about. You know, I get laid off. You know, I'm technically unemployed and looking for another job. That's unemployment. That's obviously bad. I didn't want that to happen. But there are other people who enter the labor force. They start looking for jobs. They kind of graduate into the labor force and they're counted as unemployed first. And that's the kind of unemployment we've been seeing. I mean, I think part of it is you don't really play when the unemployment level is rising. And I think that's why people were so frustrated with the Fed. But this is something I've struggled with. I mean, the job market data doesn't look that bad. And the unemployment rate needs a little asterisk beside it. So I don't know. You know,
so if we got the data that we did last Thursday and Friday, or the one before that, 2 weeks ago, and the market didn't do what it did, would people have been as nervous? No, right? No way. Because it's not that bad. It's something to pay attention to, but it's not that bad. And if there was a recession coming, companies would surely be talking about it. So John, next chart, please, again from Torsten Slack. He showed the number of times the word recession was mentioned on earnings calls. And corporations are forward-looking. They provide guidance towards investors. And you saw in 2022, rightfully so, they were super nervous about a recession coming, as was everybody. And they started mentioning it all the time. And then we're just not seeing that. Fine, a slight uptick from literally as low as it can go. But if corporations aren't worried about it, I'm not saying, like, again, not to poo-poo this, but another area of the economy that would surely be sensitive to an imminent recession are small business owners, okay? And today we found out that the NFIB Business Optimism Index is at a two-year high, and you just don't see these things heading into a recession.
No, you're absolutely right. And my counterpoint for you, as you showed that first chart, was what about small businesses? Small businesses are 55% of jobs in the U.S., and it's so hard to track hiring trends for them. You really only have the NFIB. So if there's something that worries me about the job market, it's that. It's what's happening to small businesses, the restaurant around the corner, you know, the brewery in your neighborhood, your veterinarian, your doggy daycare, which, by the way, I visited that today, seemed to be doing fine. But, you know, there's so much job market data, but it's concentrated in the largest companies. So it's hard to see, or excuse me, the smallest companies. And, you know, it's just harder to see what's happening in that segment.
Yeah, this thing is messy. The economy is uber complicated. Lastly, Sherwood had a chart of economists and the probability that they give of the economy entering a recession. And take this with a gigantic grain was it salt? That's right, salt. Because we know in 2020, literally 100% of economists predicted a recession, did not come to fruition. But be that as it may, which is a nice transition phrase, thank you very much. Be that as it may, only around 30% of economists are expecting a recession.
Yeah, well, nobody knows anything. Like, it's the one thing that I've remembered through all these years of, like, bullshit recession calls has been, you know, nobody knows anything and the economy is uber complicated. If you're going to focus on one thing, focus on the job market. But if you think there's a recession happening, you almost have to see it happening. Yeah. You can't, it's hard to front run it, right?
All of the data points that we've seen in the past couple of years in this really strange economy, how many data points have we never seen before? Well, we've never seen this before. We've never seen an economy like this. So I'm not dismissive of a cooling job market, a cooling labor market that is happening definitively. But that doesn't mean that just because historically this has led to a recession, it doesn't mean that we have to have one this time. Rules break all the time. So all right, yeah. Callie,
and the
over
other
to you.
Thing, so I'm going to add one more thing before we pivot off. And Mike knows I could talk about the job market for hours. But as an investor, you don't have to be all in or not in. Like, you can mix it up a little bit. There's a lot of gray here. If you're worried about the future, but you don't want the market rally to pass you by, you know, as are many investors, I would consider myself in that camp, you know, buy some quality bonds. put your feet in both buckets. You're totally able to do that. I mean, the market is more sophisticated than ever before. So it doesn't have to be black or white. And I think a lot of people forget that.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of black and white, bulls and bears, bears are back. Chart on, John. First time I've ever said that. How'd I do?
Not bad.
Okay. So I want to talk about bearish sentiment. I want to talk about fear in the market because as you can see here, this is the AAII survey. It's the, American Association of Individual Investors. There you go. This is a survey that they compile every week. They ask a bunch of individual investors, how do you feel about market returns over, I think it's the next 12 months? They say, I'm positive on it, I'm neutral, or I'm negative on it. So leading into last week, and remember last week was the crazy one with the Japan yen carry trade imploding. Leading into last week, we saw a good amount of bulls. I think about a month ago, bulls were the highest in the survey late 2021, which is not what you want to hear because you know what happens after that. But we saw this huge swing from, you know, investors saying they're super bullish to, oh, wait, you know, we're not feeling so good about this. We're feeling a little shaken up. Bearish sentiment or the percent of investors saying that they were bearish actually rose by, I think, 12 percentage points, which is the largest climb since late 2022. November 2022, Mike.
Talk over it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So like the depths of the inflation crisis, which is kind of crazy to me, but I guess it makes sense. I mean, that was a pretty volatile week. But I want to show you what ChartPro Matt put in here. You have the S&P overlaid, and you can see these upticks in bearish sentiment in the AAII survey before. And every time we saw this uptick in bearish sentiment, the market rebounded. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's happening here, but like,
no, it looks like we're stabilizing. It did happen.
Okay, I can say that on What Are Your Thoughts?
It factually happened. I think
I'm bottom ticking it here.
We don't make any proclamations about the future. We don't know. But we're just saying what happened now is we've seen this before, and I've done a lot of work on this, and bulls don't, like extreme bullish sentiment could persist for a long time. That is really not a great timing signal. But a spike in bearish sentiment, as we just saw, that tends to be good to carve out at least a short-term bottom. What's really unusual about this spike in bearishness is that it came in the context of a 8% sell-off.
Yeah.
Now, again, I'm not overblown, right? I'm not poo-pooing it because we have the benefit of hindsight here. But I think it was just the perfect storm of complacency, a low VIX, mm-hmm. Buffett selling half of his Apple stake, a cooling job market, the Fed not cutting, and the Japan carry trade unwinding. And it was a perfect storm. And so I think the worst is behind us. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it was a series of unfortunate events, which, I mean, that's a phrase I'm using, but it's kind of crazy. We actually got a really good ISM services report on Monday, the day when, you know, stocks were selling off and nobody paid attention to it. So when you see sell-offs like this happen, go straight to the data. Look what's happening in the economy and earnings. You know, if we're not seeing a breakdown there, then breathe a little bit easier. Fear is a little premature if that's the case. I like comparing it, and I know you've heard this before, Mike. Sorry, I'm going to repeat it again. But I like comparing fear to getting punched in the stomach. So like basically, if you know that you're about to get punched in the stomach, of course, you're going to tense up and get ready for it. That's essentially what we saw investors do this past week. You know, we saw the S&P sell off 8%, but we didn't see the big one, and investors are now tensing up, ready for it. They're not going to get sucker punched in the stomach, and that's a good thing. We're ready for it. You know, we've stepped out of the market.
If you acted on your emotions last Monday and you sold, I mean, this is why you didn't have a plan. Because what do you do now?
I want to throw another chart up.
Go ahead.
Chart on, John. 25 worst and best days. The best days for your portfolio back up against some of the worst days. And if you sell on a 2% down day, so over the past 20 years, if you sold on a 2% down day and waited 2 weeks to get back into the market, 2 weeks until the coast was clear,
you missed
out on a third of gains over that period because you missed out on the best days.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just remember that the next time you feel like you got punched in the stomach. And this is going to be an analogy I use.
I like it. We keep talking about the consumer because, as you mentioned earlier, it's 2/3 of the economy. It's everything. So goes the consumer, so goes the economy. So the Federal Reserve Bank of New York does their survey. Is this monthly or quarterly? I think it's monthly.
I think it's, oh, I was going to say quarterly.
Okay. Either way.
I don't know.
They do it here and there.
Check the stats.
So the respondents who expect their financial situation will be better off over the next year is coming down. It's going in the wrong direction. However, I would also submit to you this next chart, which shows household spending growth expectations over the next year. And that's flat. I think people really have no concept of what their spending is going to be over the next 12 months. So another survey to take with a grain of salt. But there is something that's happening with response to interest rates and what the Fed's going to do that is a little bit worrisome. So Home Depot this morning, which is a stock that I own, the CFO said categories that are components of large projects, kitchen, bath, flooring, lighting, are all under pressure. And our customers tell us it's because large projects are being deferred. Everyone's expecting rates are going to fall, so they're deferring those projects, which isn't
great.
That's
interesting.
Not great, but guess what? Rates are going to fall. And so long as between now and then things don't break, people are going to consume. They're going to do those projects that they've been putting off.
Yeah, the last part of that, the comment from the Home Depot CFO, is the biggest surprise that you just showed me. Everyone's expecting rates are going to fall, so they're deferring these projects. Listen to the first part of that sentence. Everyone's expecting rates are going to fall. When there's a consensus around something, and Michael's right, you know, they're rates are already falling. but what I'm saying is you might see a trade that goes from one side of the boat to the other. So, you know, when I hear that, I first of all think of how sophisticated Americans are now, because like, oh my gosh, could we say this 10 years ago? Probably not.
No chance. But this is deflationary. Like this in a vacuum is not what you want to see. But again, within the context of rates are falling and the Fed will lower rates and housing activity will pick up. We just saw a giant spike in refis, granted all, you know, from very low levels, but they are going to fall. Another interesting look in on the consumer is the US TSA checkpoint numbers. Chart on, please. The red line that we're looking at is 2024 compares with the previous 5 years, and it tracks it over time. And look, I think this is all-time highs, but people are traveling.
Yeah. I mean, that's bullish. People are spending money on experiences. That's the first thing that goes when you're worried about the future. So I like always hesitate to make these blanket statements about consumers, because I know the experiences are so wide in this economy. But if you're looking at this in an investment lens, this consumer spending data still looks awesome.
Yeah.
And until we see the job market fall apart, I don't see a reason for it to slow down too much.
To your point about experiences being different, this is a very bifurcated consumer that we're seeing today. A lot of companies are saying that the lower end consumer is slowing down. I don't think anybody's like, it's not a dire situation, but they're slowing down. They're all saying the same thing. The area of the economy or consumer spend that's not slowing down is the higher end. So Ferrari said, we don't see any sign of weakness. Again, these are Ferrari, so you know, the richest of the rich. We see there's no trend at all in the reduction of visits. So Ferrari total shipment going up and to the right. Simon Property, which owns Roosevelt Field and a bunch of other malls, we haven't seen a slowdown in the higher end consumer. Okay. And then also Uber, also caters to the same audience, says based on what we're seeing today, the Uber consumer is in great shape. But they said the Uber consumer, people with money. While our consumers tend to be higher income, we're not seeing any softness or trading down across any income cohort. So it is not a one size fits all. It is not 2023 when everyone was spending and there was excess savings all over the place. People are being more picky. They're choosing. And so I think that a softness, a moderation, a slowdown to normal, I understand that like triggers people and alarm bells and the hair on your back, your neck stands up, but it's okay. Like it doesn't mean that a slowdown has to lead to a catastrophe.
Yeah. And I'm going to counterpoint you really fast.
Please.
Because I love being devil's advocate. I'm standing in your shoes, Michael. I need to do it. So one other thing that worries me in the job market is almost the distribution of hiring that we're seeing. And especially in like white collar industries, you know, professional jobs, that's actually something that the BLS breaks out. And I wish I had a chart on hand, but hiring in professional sectors has been basically at zero for months now.
So is that upper middle class?
I mean, we talk about higher end consumers. I don't know if that's the executive or if that's the coder, but you know, if we see a breakdown in the job market, if we start to see a lot of layoffs come through white collar sectors, then the higher end consumer, or at least the upper middle class consumer, could break down pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Callie, you're up. Let's talk about the stock market. What's going on inside the market of stocks?
Well, fresh breath. I'm glad I can't smell your breath right now, Michael, because I might have to change my title. I'm just kidding. Fresh breath. Chart on, John. Okay, so this is as of the end of June. Remember, this is outdated, but I want to show you where we were and how far we've come. So at the end of June, we had just 25% of S&P 500 stocks outperforming the S&P 500 so far this year.
That's wild. Yeah,
that is bad. That would be the worst year since, it looks like, since 1970.
So for people that are listening and not watching, this chart that we're showing is the current year. Again, when was this, Callie? As of a few weeks ago?
End of June.
Yeah. Okay. So there was nothing really even close to resembling this. I guess the late 90s got there a little bit, but this was dire. If you are picking individual stocks, good luck.
Yeah. Good luck to every portfolio manager on Wall Street, right? Yeah. And like last year was bad. We only had about 30% of stocks that outperformed the S&P, and people were complaining about it then. It didn't feel like a bull market to the majority of investors because the bull market was only happening in a few stocks. Mm-hmm. And this year it's even worse, but good news. Chart on, John, August 8th.
We like it.
So this is as of August 8th. 38% of S&P stocks are outperforming the index. Look at that jump.
Wow.
I mean, that's the rotation right there. The rotation into small caps, rate sensitive sectors, basically everything else but tech.
So ChartKid made a chart a couple of weeks ago. We were looking at the number of stocks outperforming the index over a rolling, I can't remember, 20-day period. And it went from like base effectively zero to, I don't remember what the number spiked to, but it was a wild swing. And it's funny because that all happened, I guess, was it like 6 weeks ago or something when data started
started to cool
and we said, okay, Fed's going to cut, small caps, Equal got ahead of that and had a great run. So you like to see that. But Equal had a decent year. I'm looking right now, it's up 7% and change through whatever, 8 months a year. Not so bad.
Yeah, and I'd want to know how well it's done in the past month or so. I know it's done well. I don't have the numbers, but I mean, this is what you want to see in a bull market. Like rising growth and declining rates, that is the best potion for your portfolio. And this is what's supposed to happen. Of course, you know, there are risks out there. We just talked about the job market. I'm not trying to get too excited, but this building of the foundation in the bull market is incredibly bullish. Like That's great. That's what you want to see. It feels like a bull market now.
It does. The broadening rally is, you love to see it. As far as do you think that the story of so few stocks outperform the index, is that a Wall Street story, a portfolio manager story? Like how concerned should the average investor who goes to work, contributes to their 401k, they're not market professionals, they're not watching us. Like does this matter to them that so few stocks are outperforming?
Yeah, well, of course it matters to Wall Street portfolio managers. They make their pay based on, you know, how they're outperforming the benchmark. And you as an individual investor have the ability to, you know, have a longer time horizon, hold these stocks or hold these underperforming stocks until they, you know, if you believe in the story, until they turn back up and start, you know, blowing the S&P out of the water. So it's a problem for Wall Street, but also it's been incredibly painful for all of us. I mean, I used to work at a retail brokerage and we heard over and over again, you know, why does everybody say the market's up? My portfolio is down. Mm-hmm. And this chart basically encapsulates that.
Were you ever an individual stock picker?
I've picked a few. I'm not good at it.
Okay. Most people aren't, myself included. But speaking to the difficulty of how hard it is to pick individual stocks, Eddie Elfenbein, friend of the show, tweeted earlier today, if you had invested $10,000 in Apple on June 6th, 1983, by April 17th, 2003, so 20 years, you'd be sitting on $8,400. This shit's hard. Mm-hmm. Like even the best companies, like thinking about how long has it been since Disney how many years has Disney delivered 0% returns for its investors with a lot of ups and downs and nothing to show for it? It happens.
And the ups too. I mean, you have to think about the good days, you know, seeing a really strong rally and saying like, okay, it doesn't get better than this. I'm taking it off the table. You have to ride the bear markets, but also the crazy bull markets that make you want to cash out every single day.
Over the last 10 years. Last 10 years, total return for Disney. Take a guess. One of the bluest blue chip names in the entire planet. One of the best companies of all time. Last 10 years. 20%. 7.
Oh, I was kind of close.
7%.
For a 10-year return?
Well, it's not a bad guess. For individual investors, Disney investors.
Oh, not a great return.
7% over the last 10 years. And again, clearly one of the premier companies, and the S&P over the same time for some comparison is up 10 years.
400.
That sounds pretty high. I'm going to guess. You know what? I have it right here.
Are you going to look it up?
I'm not going to guess. I'm just going to go to the screen. 234. So 234.
Okay.
234% versus 7. Not good.
No.
Not good. Okay.
Wait, before we get on, I want to show one thing. So can you put the chart back up, John? The last one. The percentage of S&P stocks outperforming as of August 8th. Okay, perfect. So I just want to show you. The best year for stock pickers was 2001, which is so crazy to me because that's a year when the S&P fell 13%. Yet two-thirds of stocks did better than negative 13%.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, yeah, true. Like if you're outperforming the index, it might be on the way down too. But you got to remember that was during the tech bubble. You know, if you were a tech investor, you got slammed. But you know, everybody else got hit too, but not as hard.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
So
interesting.
Callie, you were the chief strategist at a brokerage firm.
Yeah.
One of the things that individual investors love to pay attention to are the analysts, the upgrades, the downgrades, the buys, the holds, the sells. Where do you stand? I don't think we've ever spoken about how analysts cover the stock market. Do you pay attention to that stuff?
Well, I have to tell you about how I started my career with this stuff. So I was a stocks reporter at Bloomberg. Actually, even before that, I was a tech reporter. I was an intern on the tech desk. And my day in, day out was just reading about upgrades and downgrades because that's one of the catalysts that moves the stock.
Yeah,
and if you wake up one day and you see like your Disney, for example, is up 5%, there's a good chance that an analyst stepped out and said, I'm like upping my price target. I'm upping this from a hold to a buy. It matters, but I think to you and I, Mike, it probably leads us down a bad path. As long-term investors, I mean, I'm assuming here, but long-term investors who are likely investing on the story, investing on the brand, a lot of those price targets that analysts put out are 12-month price targets. I don't know if you're going to buy and sell in 12 months, but I'm not.
I'm buying, selling, holding, and buying and selling in 12 months for sure. All right, so your former employer, Bloomberg, did a report about analyst upgrades and downgrades and what moves the market and how you might be able to outperform the market. And I thought this was interesting, fairly intuitive, but I don't know if it would be to most investors. So a company that has consensus buys, Apple, has 47 buys, zero holds, zero sells. I'm making that up, but like, right? So when a company is universally adored, there's nobody left to upgrade it. Chances are that a lot of the optimism is baked into the pie. Now, in the case of Apple and all these tech giants, they just kept jumping over the high bar, but most of the time it doesn't work that way. So actually, when analysts do upgrade a stock because the story changed, that tends to be fairly bullish if you invest in that way systematically. So not just picking and choosing, oh, I follow this analyst, just as a whole. So here's what Bloomberg said. They said, sometimes the best equity investments are not necessarily the most beloved companies. Contrary to intuition, investors can capture outsized returns by investing in stocks that are not the highest rated by analysts, but are becoming better rated, which makes sense. It's not bad news or good news. It's better or worse news. So they say, avoid the consensus buy recommendations from analysts and instead invest in stocks whose consensus analyst ratings have improved the most in the recent past. So they did a quantitative study, chart on please, John, showing the yellow line, which is their US large and mid-cap total return index versus the red line, which shows they're calling it the improvers, the ANR, which is the analyst function of Bloomberg, the ANR improvers total return index. And they show that, the performance was significantly better. 1,028% cumulative returns over a 20-year period compared to a 700% for the cap-weighted index. That's 10.4% a year versus 12.25. So what do you think?
So analysts can keep their jobs, right? They're doing good things, right?
It matters.
Yeah, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Markets are all about expectations. If you're getting in when the good story is baked in, then I mean, you probably missed it, right?
And I think also, if you think about a lot of the companies that get upgraded, like almost by definition, these are companies that are probably struggling, but by the time they get an upgrade, analysts aren't upgrading the stock for no reason. Like their reputation, their job is on the line. They're upgrading it probably ostensibly after a big move, right? Because that's what happens. You get an earnings report. You say, okay, now I know 4 times a year I get the earnings report. The story has changed. The fundamentals of the company, the competition, the guidance, whatever. But if you were to do that systematically, if you were to buy upgrades quantitatively, which by the way, maybe this is an ETF coming. Who knows? But I thought it was interesting.
Not a bad idea.
Not a terrible strategy. Anything to add here, Callie?
Well, I think that's it. The other thing I'll throw out there is price targets, analyst ratings. They're marketing too. Like it's not all, you know,
who are they marketing?
Authentic research.
Who are they marketing to?
It's mostly institutional. And with price targets, like that's definitely marketing. I don't know a single strategist who would step out and say, I actually believe the S&P 500 is going to 6,000 at the end of the year. They're like, I ran it through my models. I did my calculations around
8-10%
interest rates in the economy. And yeah, 8-10%. You know, we have to throw a number out there. Our institutional clients need a number to input. So I don't want to be like super, super skeptical and super jaded, but there's an element of that too. And I think that probably erodes the value a little bit.
All right, you're up. Topic 6, Callie, what do we got?
All right, so we're going to go international here. Talk about a pivot party. Chart on, John. Okay, so global central banks. So central banks all around the world, of which there are many, cutting at the fastest pace since COVID. And obviously we haven't cut yet, but the ECB has cut. I believe the Bank of England has cut. We have banks cutting rates. And that matters, right? I mean, we just talked about a yen carry trade imploding. The Bank of Japan hiked rates, surprised everybody, and screwed up one of the most popular trades on Wall Street. I think this is really interesting, Michael. I mean, especially if you're waiting for international stocks to finally outperform and you believe a loosening of policy can get us there. I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows. But, you know, this is interesting. Economies are falling out of step with the U.S. economy.
I'm looking at the CME FedWatch tool, and it's showing that the 53.5% implied probability of a 50 basis point rate cut is basically 50-50 between 50 and 25. What are central banks around the world doing in terms of their cutting? Are they doing it like, is it a baby cut or are they going big?
I don't think many of them are going big. Maybe smaller central banks are going bigger, but the ECB, I think, had a 25 bip cut, which is a baby cut in my view. And to be fair, we haven't seen this like cutting and this expectation for looser policy and better growth. We haven't seen that bleed into international stocks yet. I mean, the ACWI, the MSCI All Country World Index, beat the S&P 500 by a percentage point in July, which isn't great. That's like pretty normal. You see that come back and forth from time to time. I mean, the dollar is falling, but at the same time, international stocks can't really get off the mat. You know, I'd expect a little bit more from them. But I want to show you something else, Michael, and I'm not sure if all of you have seen this yet, but this chart blows my mind.
It's a good one. Go ahead. Chart on.
Okay. This is so crazy to me, this breakdown. And it makes sense, right? Like the U.S. market isn't the same as developed markets, isn't the same as emerging markets. But markets overseas are much more exposed to value stocks than they are tech. I mean, look at the financial slice of the pie in developed and emerging markets. I mean, Europe's biggest sector is banks right now.
Yeah.
And that's really good news. A, if you can get higher growth out of it, but B, if we see the value-oriented sectors come alive. And you have to remember too, like the US is the center of all financial markets. So if we see banks on the US side get a little bit better, catch a bid, which they have been.
Yeah, they're acting very well.
Yeah, we could see that bleed into Europe as well. Maybe this is wishful thinking on my end because I just really want international stocks to like do the damn thing.
Me too. It's been a minute. Yeah. Callie, you pay more attention to the Fed than I do. What are you expecting, hoping, curious to see at Jackson Hole? Which is not an official Fed meeting, but it sort of is.
Powell speaks for 30 minutes. So, I mean, that's all that matters, right? I'm just kidding. The decision matters too. But everybody listens to what Powell says and they extrapolate based on that. Well, you have to remember last year he had, so actually 2 years ago, I'll start with 2022. The Jackson Hole speech was 5 minutes long. And it was basically Powell coming to the podium and saying, inflation is much too high. We need to deal with this. Slamming his hand on the podium, walking away. And then last year, it was a little more ornate. It was like 20 minutes long. And he was talking about balancing risks and, you know, steering policy by the stars. He had a really, really illustrative line at the end that was talking about navigating by the stars. So he was a little less hammered down and more, you know, we're trying to balance things out. This year's going to be interesting. I think he walks it back a little bit, Michael. I think he talks a little bit more about the unemployment rate rising. I don't think he capitulates and says that the job market is weak by any means, but I think he softens the language around it a little bit more, especially because if the cut's coming in September, this is the perfect time to take a step down, at least in rhetoric.
We got softening producer prices today. What is the street expecting for consumer prices tomorrow?
So more of the same, basically. The street's expecting, I think, a modest uptick in month-over-month CPI, but for the most part, we're looking at year-over-year data and the three-month average of month-over-month changes. Basically, what I'm saying is 1 month doesn't really change a trend. You have to see a trend of reports. So yeah, probably just more of the same. Slowing in services, slowing in rent. You know, based on PPI, I think you could say pretty easily that we're going to see, you know, pretty low goods inflation. I looked at CPI consensus today and it wasn't too shocking. I think core CPI year over year was about 2.9. And you have to remember too, the Fed cares about PCE. PCE runs, I believe, a little bit lower than CPI. So, you know, if you look at the Fed's targets for PCE, I think they're expecting around 2.8 as the median this year, and we're already there.
And PCE, so the Fed that's consumer spending effectively, right?
It's consumer spending, yeah. But CPI could be that first hint to what we could see in PCE in August. July, I had my months wrong.
Over the years, we've seen the market react to, like in the aftermath of the GFC in like, I don't know, 2013, 14, whatever, it was non-farm payrolls. Like that was a big economic event for the market. Over the last couple of years, it's been inflation, CPI, PCE, whatever, what have you. And last week, we rallied the shit out of stocks on initial jobless claims coming in not as hot as we feared. Do you remember a time that the market was moving on a weekly job report?
Actually, yeah, I do.
Go ahead. Hit me. 2013,
2014, around the taper tantrum. It happened. I was a stocks reporter. I had to watch that happen. Yeah, jobless claims were really cool for a hot minute. And then I think it pivoted along to the job market or the jobs report or retail sales or something. But it's so fascinating to see the market's focus just jump around to different reports. And looking back, you know, understanding why the environment was that way. And to be fair, I mean, I'm looking at initial jobless claims. I'm looking at continuing jobless claims. That's a leading indicator in the job market. I don't think your signal gets any better than that.
Okay. We're going to skip to make the case, but I will make the case for a movie that I saw last night. That was a hell of a lot of fun. One of the most absurd movies I've ever seen in my life, in a good way. The movie's called Trap, M. Night Shyamalan. You've seen his stuff. You know who he is. He's a one of one. Nobody else could have made a movie so ridiculous and so utterly enjoyable. So if you want to support the theaters like I do, particularly IMAX, I'm a shareholder, go see Trap. A lot of fun. Okay, chart. The mystery chart is. That didn't make sense. Chart off, please. Let me set that up a little bit better. Thank you. Let's roll that back.
Chart. We're doing
Rechart that chart. All right. So one area of the stock market that is concerning to me, and I respect the stock market, even though it's predicted 97 of the last two recessions, I respect what the market is doing. To me, that there's a lot of noise, but sometimes there's some signal there too. So I saw this chart, and I'm like, it's not great. It's not exactly what you want to see. So I'll talk over the chart on, please, John. This is a ratio chart, and I'm going to give you as many clues as possible so that you can nail this, Callie. In the denominator is the S&P 500. And on top of that is one of the most important sectors. I know there's only 11, they're all important, but this is a sector that we spoke a lot about today, and it's going the wrong direction. You don't want to see this. So what's the numerator, Callie? Any guesses?
Money supply, obviously.
No, I'm sorry. No,
I'm just kidding.
Oh, that's good. Got nerd me. Joke. Way over my head.
Financial. It wouldn't be financials though, because financials are doing better. Tech? Is it the tech sector?
Close-ish, I guess.
Retail?
Sure. Yes. It is. Sure. It is consumer discretionary. And this is breaking down. It's consumer discretionary divided by the S&P 500. And I'm sorry. That's not what this is. Well, it sort of is, but I apologize. All right.
Equal weight.
It's the equal weight. So The chart that I saw, John, next chart, please. My bad. So this was the chart that I saw. It's XLY divided by SPY. And I thought, all right, well, whatever. Like Tesla and Amazon are 40% of the index. What happens if we normalize it? And John, previous chart. And then I said, okay, let's look at the equal weight. And I was like, oh shit, this doesn't look better. This doesn't look any better. So you want to see these consumer names leading the market. And you've seen a ton of breakdowns. Two companies that I bought as they got destroyed, Starbucks and McDonald's, one stock that I sold, Nike. There's a lot of pressure out there in a lot of consumer retail names. And that is like, it's not great. It jives with a lot of what we've heard from these companies, which is moderating softness at the lower end. So I'm going to be keeping my eye on that.
Yeah. I would be interested to see which industries within the retail sector are breaking down. Because I remember looking at this at the end of last year, and there was just such a gap between goods producers and services companies, like travel stocks, for example. And of course, you have to put like the huge asterisk if you're not looking at equal weight beside Tesla and Amazon. Because like Michael said, 40% of the sector. You can't ignore that.
I'm looking at XRT divided by SPY, and it's no better. All right, Callie, did you have fun today?
I had so much fun.
That was a phenomenal.
I hope I brought the fire.
You did. Phenomenal debut. I want to point to our listeners and viewers, and thank you for tuning in today on this summer Tuesday. I want to point to our listeners to Callie's incredible blog, Optimistic Callie. Where do we send people to?
Yeah, optimistically. So optimistically, like the word, except with I-E instead of Y at the end. Optimistically.com. I talk about markets and the economy, more of what I said today. Hot and fresh stuff every Monday. Subscribe.
All right. Thank you to Rocket Money. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Josh will be back next week. Back to usual. Callie, you were incredible. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week.
Happy trading.
Whether you're just getting started as an investor or you're managing a multi-million dollar portfolio, Ritholtz Wealth Management has the solution for you. It all starts with building the right financial plan. To speak with a certified financial planner today, visit ritholtzwealth.com. Don't forget to check us out at youtube.com/thecompoundRWM. Make sure to leave a rating and review on your favorite podcasting app. If you love investing podcasts, check out Michael and Ben every Wednesday morning on Animal Spirits. Thanks for listening.